still the real estate business. We're all capital allocators. There's cycles. We're at the low point of a cycle. So things will, they're terrible right now. It'll get better. And then we'll have a bunch of irrational exuberance and capital will start flowing in back into the real estate business and we'll get to another bubble and then it'll pop again. And so I don't think over the next 10 years that is going to change much.
Hi, I'm Gordon Lamphere, and welcome to the Real Finds Podcast, the podcast that interviews key entrepreneurs, activists, and researchers shaping the real estate industry and, as a result, our world. On today's podcast, we will be speaking with Robert Solomon. Robert is president and chief legal officer at BLT Enterprises, a waste management and commercial real estate firm with over $2 billion in commercial real estate investment. On the podcast, we discuss the powerful untapped niches in the industrial real estate sector, strategies to invest in last mile delivery, and why commercial real estate property management is best kept in-house. It's well worth a listen.
Hey, Robert. Thanks for hopping on the podcast.
Oh, you're welcome. Glad to be here.
So why real estate?
Well, I would love to say that's in my blood and in my family's blood, but I graduated from UC Santa Barbara back in 1991 with a 4.0, but that was my blood alcohol level, and went and traveled for a bit and then got a job as a mortgage broker, and I was selling residential mortgages in 92, 93, and then got out of that business for a variety of reasons, and then went to work for a law firm. Became a paralegal and got convinced to go to law school. And then when I graduated from law school, I got a job at a great litigation shop in Los Angeles, about 80 lawyers at the time. And they had a small real estate department. And I was about a month into the being a litigator as a first-year lawyer and figured I was going to get fired because I just had no idea what I was doing. But they had an opening in the real estate department. And so I moved over into the real estate department. And the first day, I went from being in the library doing a bunch of research about insurance law to negotiating a purchase and sale agreement. The partner at the time that I worked for, one of the partners, played a lot of golf and expected his associates to do most of the work. So I got thrown right into it and loved it. So that's how I got into the real estate business originally.
So I'm guessing when you were starting out as a young associate, you saw a lot of deals from the legal perspective. One of the things that we love to talk about on this podcast is deal strategy. And as somebody who probably saw a lot of deals, what's your ultimate strategy when you're looking at investigating the possibility of a deal?
Well, from our company's perspective, we're unique in some ways. You know, we don't have any third-party investors. We don't have an investment committee. We don't have IRR hurdles. And our business, we've got two lines of business. We started in the waste and recycling industry, and we're still in that, or also, you know, own and invest in real estate and develop primarily industrial real estate. But our goal is cash flow. So when we look at any deal, we're looking to see how quickly we can get to a sustainable, durable, long-term cash flow that meets a certain return criteria for us. So that's how we look at it.
And so what is typically that return criteria?
Well, it depends, right? When interest rates are zero, the return the returns get lower. But what we try to do is look at any project on a 10-year cash flow basis. I would say a 10-year hold period. We almost everything we buy, other than a few value add projects, we think that we're going to buy it, either buy core and hold it, or value add to core and hold it in the long term. And so we're just really looking to get some sort of good spread between, you know, risk free return with treasuries over the, you know, the return that we can get on a stabilized 10-year cash flow. And so, you know, in today's environment, we've only bought one building in 2 years because when treasuries are 5% or 4.5% or 4%, it's tough to make a deal pencil.
It is tough to make a deal sometimes and outpace treasuries in this market. What is that building that you mentioned that you purchased?
So we bought a 90,000 square foot metal industrial building in Las Vegas on about 9 acres. It was owned by PepsiCo. They surplus property room. They sold it to us, leased it back on a short-term basis. It's right in central Las Vegas, about a half mile off the strip. And for us, you know, a lot of other buyers are looking at it as redevelopment opportunities, but for us, it's a great low coverage site. There's a lot of need for that type of use. And as our brokers have pointed out, don't redevelop the site because you're going to turn it into, you know, a nice low coverage building with lots of excess land. And then you're going to max out the FAR. Well, that's a lot of, you're building an apple and there's a lot of apples. And you're seeing the rise in vacancy right now in Las Vegas. So keep it in orange. There's not a lot of competition for that type of site. So we're going to leave it as is, do some capital improvements when they move out, but keep it as a low coverage site.
So can you mention to any of our listeners who don't fully understand what a low covered site is? Can you explain that a little further?
Sure. Think about it, the size of the building in relation to the size of the land. So in a I'm going to say traditional, but everything's different. But when you look at buying a warehouse or distribution facility, you're looking at the building would be on 100,000 square feet of land. The building's going to be about 40,000 square feet. On a low coverage site on 100,000 square feet of land, maybe the building's 5,000 to 10,000 square feet. That low coverage gives you the ability to use that land for a bunch of different things, including parking your trucks, storage of outdoor equipment. And that's been as properties, at least in Southern California and California specifically, have been redeveloped into something higher and better use. You kind of lost a lot of industrial land. We look at it as a addition by subtraction. And so these land sites become much more valuable, especially, you know, we're next to the two largest ports in the world. We've got almost 40 million residents in California. We've got the rise of e-commerce and last mile distribution. You need a place to store all your trucks, containers coming off the ports. And so that's where a low coverage site is very helpful.
Do you think the push for development is primarily what's driving kind of the decline of low covered sites? Or do you think it's beyond that? It's just something we find overwhelmingly that communities are against it. Do you think that's a factor as well in the West Coast?
Yeah, I mean, we've had massive expansion in industrial development in Southern California over the last 15 years. So part of the community pushback is just industrial development has moved into the urban interface. And so you're not having a lot of separation between industrial properties and residential. So that's been a huge issue. Also, some of the uses that are used for a low coverage site, which today, now that private equity is involved in it, it's called IOS, industrial outdoor storage.
Yeah.
People don't like that. They don't like that use next to their house or apartment.
PE loves a good brand name.
Once it's branded, then I'm behind the curve on that one. Too much competition.
In terms of that, is that kind of been your focus of your fund? Is that really to focus on niche asset groups that aren't necessarily, as you would put it, branded or haven't been as mainstreamed? Is that primarily where your focus is, or do you dabble in more of those mainstream asset classes as well?
So we spend most of our time, the asset class that we spend most of our time on is industrial. And when the company started buying industrial assets in the late 80s, early 90s, there wasn't that was niche. There wasn't an institutional appetite to acquire a 100,000 square foot industrial building. You know, back in 91, you could buy a 100,000 square foot industrial building in Los Angeles for $3 million. Now it's, you know, $35 million. So they were dirty. They weren't sexy. And look, the real estate business was not as institutionalized back in the 80s and 90s. But as it became more institutionalized and more institutional capital came into the real estate asset classes, you couldn't write a big check to buy an industrial building. You could write a big check to buy an office building, a million square foot office building in Manhattan. So we were niche. It just so happens that industrial real estate has become in favor over the last 10, 15 years for a variety of reasons. So I mean, that's kind of what our focus is and why our focus is. And it was never that we were looking for a niche asset class. It's because of our other core business, which at the time we still have, we were entitling, building, and operating transfer stations and recycling centers for municipal solid waste, which were generally in the urban core next to transportation nodes in cities in California. And so we were in those areas, and as we were entitling a transfer station that took anywhere from 2 to 10 years to get entitled, we could buy an industrial building, get cash flow immediately. So that's why we started buying industrial buildings.
Industrial has been an asset class that's highly coveted these days, and there's so many reasons for that, and we've discussed that at length on this podcast. But I'm curious, in particular, as somebody who has dabbled in it for so long, why do you think that there hasn't been nearly as much development as demand? Do you think it's regulatory? What's primarily driving the supply constraints of Southern California?
A lot of it has to do with no land, especially today we're out of land. It has to do with land prices in the urban core. If you look at the downtown Los Angeles industrial base, you've got a lot of B and C class industrial buildings that have 12 to 14 foot clear height that haven't been earthquake retrofitted, were built in the 30s and 40s. But the land price was so high that you couldn't make it pencil to aggregate a bunch of old buildings, tear them down, and build a new industrial building. So I think that's held it back a bunch. But over the last 10 years, there's been a massive amount of development, not in the coastal parts of California, but in the Inland Empire, where it's probably been overbuilt. You had a lot of buildings done got built in COVID, and now you're running into, I think there's probably 200 buildings above 200,000 square feet in the Inland Empire that are vacant. So the regulatory environment, cost of land, and the lack of land has helped keep it constrained, the supply-demand imbalance in coastal California. But as you got out the Inland Empire, there was just so much land, and the building got in front of the regulatory pressures to slow it down.
And so what do you think the primary regulatory pressures are that are slowing it down?
Well, in California, we have CEQA, the California Environmental Quality Act, which requires most projects over a certain size. They trigger a CEQA analysis, which requires the simplest form, an environmental impact report. That environmental impact report can take a year to 2 years to get done. It's got a really low standard of review, and so it opens you up to being challenged by opponents of the project.
Do you see that, like, there are certain niche classes that are able to better withstand regulatory push, or is it just generally something that's pervasive across the whole industrial asset class?
It's pervasive in California over any project because of NIMBYism that you'd want to build of any scale or significance in California, whether it's an industrial project or an apartment building. I mean, we have a need for 200,000 units a year in California just to keep up with our demand, residential units, and we're far behind. And there's a lot of reasons. I'm not going to just make it a regulatory issue, but the regulatory pressures are very difficult.
So one of the other difficult things that we always like to talk about is tenant relations. And I think you guys as a whole have been very effective at dealing with a wide range of tenants, particularly Fortune 500 partnerships. And so I'm curious, what have you found has been your keys to successfully not only acquiring, but also maintaining long-term Fortune 500 relationships?
I think the most important thing, and it's kind of embedded in our DNA, is that a tenant is our customer. They're not a tenant. They're our customer. When I was in high school, I was a waiter at a Mexican restaurant in Los Angeles, and there was a sign in the kitchen that said the number one rule is the customer is always right. And the number two rule is if the customer is wrong, check rule number one. And so customer service and customer is key to what we do. And our founder, Bernie Huberman, would always like to say when we were meeting with tenants, we want to be your first landlord and your last landlord. We know that we're not necessarily going to be your only landlord or your first landlord or your last, but that's how we look at you, and we want you to look at us. And so if you have a building that's not large enough for you, let's see if we can either expand the building, find another building in our portfolio, or if we don't own it, we'll go tell us what you need, and we'll go buy the building and rent it to you. If you need to downsize your building, we'll either find you another building in our portfolio, we'll go buy a smaller building and put you in that building and let you out of the lease. So, and then we listen intently to our customers' needs. So everything, most of the things that we do in-house. And one of the most important thing is asset and property management. So we don't outsource that. So we have an in-house full property management team and asset management team that we're visiting our buildings once a month. We stay in front of our customers. We talk to them. When a lease comes up for renewal, we don't have to get the highest price per square foot to be satisfied on a renewal. We don't have an investment committee. We don't have any outside investors. We don't have any hurdle rates that we have to reach. We're happy to have higher lease rates, of course, but we can leave some money on the table in exchange for a win-win relationship with our tenant, our customer.
Why do you think in-house management is important? And I'm saying this, by the way, as someone whose own portfolio, we do all our management in-house. But why is it important to you guys?
Well, two things. You start with, they're our customers. So we want to be dealing with our customers. We don't want someone else dealing with our customers. We have a certain way of how we approach things. And I think that's a huge component of it. And we can control the quality of the work on the property management, asset management side, and the cost better.
Where do you find that cost control is the most important in our industry? We've seen increasingly, I'll say from our perspective, that labor costs in terms of construction and doing things and just on a daily basis, in terms of the construction-based labor costs are what are driving deals and making things difficult. Are you seeing the same thing in California?
Yeah, I mean, what's the phrase? Prices go up like a rocket and they go down like a feather. You would think that we would see lowering prices, but we're bidding out a number of projects right now, and prices, they've come down a little bit on the margins, but not what you would think they would come down after the last 2 years of a slowdown in the industry. And I don't know, labor is a huge part of it. I think we have a labor problem in our business, and commodity prices, even though you can look at the price of lumber and that's come down from the COVID peaks, it's still not that less expensive to do framing, for example. Concrete's more expensive today than it was a year ago. So I don't know why. Prices should be lower, but they're not.
Yeah, you would think so, but I keep doing deals and the prices really haven't dropped from COVID peaks. I'm curious, it makes adding value particularly difficult when costs are going up and up and up. How do you guys approach the value add process to deals, particularly in such a tight market in many ways? What are you seeing?
So look, the last 2 years have been extremely difficult for us to find any value add projects or core projects that make any sense. But traditionally, look, at the end of the day, you make your money on the buy in real estate. And so finding assets that you can get at the right basis, that you can be relatively certain, I'm going to say relatively certain on what your cost to rehab the property is. Always seems like it takes longer and costs more to do a value add project than we sit down and we originally budget. But you know, our approach on a value add project is we pro forma, we take a look at how long we think it's going to take us to convert. I'm assuming that we're taking we've done a number of value add projects. So we've taken a 220,000 square foot manufacturing facility and converted it to an industrial building, distribution facility, and leased it to Amazon on 16 acres. We looked at that project and said, okay, that's probably going to take us 6 months to do the rehab and 6 months to get it leased out. All right, let's put a year to do the rehab and a year to lease it out. So we'll build in 2 years of vacancy in our pro forma, and it's going to cost us, let's say, $65 a square foot to do the rehab. Make it $100 a foot. And does it work? And are you getting a good return with all those assumptions built in? Because our philosophy is let's figure out the downside on any project and the upside will take care of itself. And we've been, knock on wood, fairly successful with that approach.
So let's talk about that deal in particular. So what drove you originally to look at acquiring that site? And then we can go through and kind of talk about how you rehabbed it and then found Amazon as a potential tenant. So did you buy it with the intention of thinking, hey, this is a great site for Amazon, or was this a spec opportunity?
I mean, it's a combination of those two. I mean, when we originally saw the project, we were not the successful bidder. So someone else got it under contract. What attracted us to the project was it was at a time in the northern San Diego market where there was a premium for large buildings on excess land. Historically, the larger the building were in San Diego, the leasing rates were lower. But it was just, look, a supply-demand issue. There was a number of large tenants in the market, Amazon being one of them, looking for larger buildings, and there were none available. So we tracked, when we were the number two bidder, so the first loser, we tracked the deal with our brokers and found out that it was falling out of escrow and re-engaged with the seller. And on execution of the purchase agreement, we put up $1 million hard, because we had already done all of our due diligence and we were able to execute on the acquisition because we were there as the original buyer was trying to retrade the seller. And we gave them a number and said, we'll put up $1 million hard. And so hard meaning non-contingent on execution of the purchase agreement. So that project, what attracted us to it is larger building, but a lot of excess land. It was a 220,000 square foot building on 16 acres. So there was a lot of room for trailer parking. It was also demisable because we were a little worried, again, worry about the downside and the upside will take care of itself. What if we are wrong about the need for a 220,000 square foot distribution facility in that market? Can we demise it into two and have 200,000 square foot buildings for tenants? Yes, the answer was yes, we could do that. It was easily demisable. So that helped us get comfortable on our downside risk. And then the upside was, okay, well, there's a premium for a larger building in that market at the time.
How did you guys go about the rehab process? What was the way in which you found that you could add ultimate value?
So it's part art and part science. So we had a bunch of different plans and schemes prepared so that it can be converted into a distribution facility. We didn't, though, tear out originally all of the manufacturing space. And we had these beautiful boards prepared by our architects, and we would do tours, and we would show everyone in our marketing materials what we could do. You would walk into the site, and it was really hard to envision it. So probably 6 months into that process, and we're in a market that's on fire for tenant demand, and we hadn't received one inquiry in writing for an offer. So we walked the site again and looked at it and said, no one can see what this is. We can see in one portion of it, the 32 foot clear height building, but you don't know that it's all the entire building. So we went and we demoed everything. We left a few bathrooms in there because you always hope that you can leave the kitchen and bathroom in there because it's just more expensive for square foot to put those back in. And we bought a golf cart, because it was a large site. And when we would do tours, we'd take people in the golf cart and we could drive them around the entire building, which was now open. And you could see the entire warehouse. We would drive around the entire site in the golf cart and people had vision. And it was much easier to get to a lease execution.
And when you were doing this process, did you have a short list of bidders that you knew were going to be potential individuals to lease the site, or did you kind of spec it out knowing that there were a number of them in the market?
I'll say we had an aspirational list of bidders. You know, we had heard, we have the Eric Stark from Cushman & Wakefield down in San Diego did a phenomenal job. He knew who was in the market at the time. They were on our list. That's who he targeted. And we were able to land Amazon. We were very fortunate. And with Amazon, as you probably know, the deal is never done until the lease is signed. No. I've had leases on their desk for signature and they've walked away.
Oh, so I, I can talk about it from the real estate world, and I can talk about it from the venture capital world as well, that we have many partners who have engaged with them. They're an interesting bunch. I'll be politically correct. An interesting bunch.
But once you get a lease signed with them, they're a great tenant.
They're a great tenant.
Yeah.
So in terms of that, let's dive into kind of, we've talked a lot about this individual site, which is great, but I think one of the things that's driven the market in particular isn't really an individual site right now, it's interest rates. So what are you seeing in the current interest rate?
Well, I'm glad that you didn't ask me to forecast what's happening, because my crystal ball is broken.
Jerome Powell isn't on the podcast today, so yeah. It's okay.
All right, thanks. The interest rates have come down a bit, as you know, both on the long end of the curve and the short end of the curve. Not as much yet on the short end of the curve, but most of our deals are on a, you know, core project where we're trying to get 10-year financing is based on long-term interest rates. The problem that we have on the acquisition side is that the seller's expectations on prices don't match where interest rates are. And so you still are looking at a negative arbitrage environment if you use debt. If you're an all-cash buyer and you've got really low hurdles for your returns, it's a really good time to buy. If you need to use debt or you have a higher hurdle rate, it's still very difficult to find opportunities. And in Southern California, there's not a lot of quality projects for sale. We have the issue of Prologis and Rexford and other large private equity PE real estate firms that have bought a lot of real estate. And, you know, the REITs don't need to sell, don't want to sell. They need to have cash flow. And a lot of the private equity firms that have bought industrial projects over the last, say, 2, 3, 4 years, it's a terrible time to sell. And so especially most of those would be value add projects. And if they're not at the end of their fund life, they're not going to sell. And so but if they are, then they need to show profit on a sale of a building today. So, if you were in a private equity firm and you bought, let's just say you bought $500 million worth of projects in the last 3 years in Southern California, and you go to sell one and market to market, you're going to have to mark to market the rest of your assets. And you're going to have probably a problem with your investors. So this is not a lot of things transacting.
Yeah, we can say we're seeing very similar things in the Chicago market, which is also a heavy logistics-driven market. I've gone with several buyers who are essentially all cash buyers to look at a number of assets, and the prices I'm seeing and the cap rates, and some of it is predictable given demand, but some of it is just outrageous. Trying to find value in that is becoming increasingly difficult. Are you seeing that there's maybe value outside of other asset classes, or do we just have to, or sorry, in other asset classes, or do we just have to wait for maybe a little bit more distress and then the opportunity for investors to hop back in?
Well, let me unpack that. So we've been waiting for more distress in industrial for 2 years and we haven't seen much of it. So I don't think we're going to see thematically a lot of distress in the industrial market unless, and I'll use the Inland Empire of Southern California as an example, if those 200 buildings, it's probably 40 million square feet of vacancy. If that demand stays dried up for the next 12 to 24 months, that means you got 36 to 48 months of no demand on 40 million square feet of product, even though it's a billion square foot market. The Inland Empire, that's a lot of buildings. And so again, haven't seen the distress that we've been waiting for. I think you're going to find situational opportunities for some distress. From our perspective, we don't necessarily need distress. We just need to have some positive arbitrage on our cap rates versus our debt. It's not a very good business to be in if your cost of your debt exceeds your yield on your rent.
So outside of industrial, are there any asset classes that you think that maybe the arbitrage is a little bit better?
Yes. Currently today, yes, depending upon your risk tolerance. We'll start with multifamily. I think there's some opportunities in multifamily. There's a little bit more distress in multifamily, I think, than in industrial. And I think there's a good arbitrage opportunity there. And then office, but that's just taking a lot more. You're going further out on the risk curve on that. But if you believe that everything reverts to the mean, then there's a good bet in office, but you've got to be prepared to take some losses, and you know, there's high risk, high return. And if we get to 7%, 6.5% unemployment, and everyone says, and there's a change in equilibrium between the employer-employee relationship and employers demand that everyone go back to work, you'll start seeing offices get filled up.
I think for a lot of office projects, it comes down to just, I know this sounds so corny, but price, entry price. We've seen overwhelmingly within our portfolio and some of our investors that we've worked with that there are entry points that work, and you can turn buildings from red to green pretty quickly if you buy them low enough. Have you accomplished that in your portfolio in either creative spaces or a traditional office?
Not in this cycle and past cycles we have. In this cycle, we had a large value add project that we sold in 2022, March of 2022, a great time to be a seller, a terrible time to be a buyer. But we wanted to defer the gain with 1030 exchanges, and we bought some really great creative office projects that are still vacant. But where our price discovery has been on that is on our leasing. So we recently cut our lease rates in half and now are getting more tours, and we actually are in negotiations right now for one of those buildings.
So what inspired you to dive into creative offices in the post 2020?
We got into it in about 2012. We moved our corporate offices down to Santa Monica, and Santa Monica was kind of in the path of progress of creative office conversions. Lots of old industrial buildings that serviced the Santa Monica airport during World War II and before that. And there's a huge entertainment, technology, and media convergence in Southern California. Santa Monica was kind of right in the middle of it. And we saw some opportunities to buy some buildings at a pretty low basis. We had great brokers that found some really great opportunities for us. And I can't stress enough, relationships with our tenants as customers is huge, and equally important is relationship with brokers, which I'll call our partners. They're the kind of the lifeblood of finding really great opportunities. We sometimes find them on our own, but for the most part, we found our best opportunities at brokers that we've done business with throughout the years. And they kind of showed us the entire market in Santa Monica, and we were able to find some really good entry points, buildings that were in great locations that had good bones, that also had parking to satisfy an office need as opposed to an industrial need. And that's a huge selling point when you're doing a creative office conversion, and making sure that you can satisfy the not only the code parking requirement, but also the tenant demand on the parking requirement. So that's how we jumped into it in the 20 teens. And beginning of 2022, we saw a differentiation between a traditional mid and high rise office building and a single story brick and timber wood bow truss building. And so we were still seduced by the opiate of that, and the market was still doing fairly well in early 2022 for creative office leasing. And then it fell off a cliff.
It sounds like you're starting to see growth, though, in terms of cutting rates and really diving in and building things up. I'm curious, has converting and repositioning assets been like a generally large feature of your market? I know for us, that's something that we explore.
Yeah, I think that's the best opportunities for us to be able to grow our balance sheet is doing conversions. Take it, and not necessarily creative office conversions. I'm not sure we would do one without a tenant in tow right now, but taking an antiquated industrial building and maybe acquiring adjacent property and building a new Class A project. That's where there's some really good opportunity. I think that's your opportunities over the next 10 years.
And in terms of that, what are the kind of properties that you think primarily are your best opportunities? Do you think it's that, you know, Class C or D industrial that's kind of in an infill location? Or what do you think is necessarily the hottest asset to look out for?
Again, it depends what your risk tolerance and your return criteria is. But for us, looking at infill C and D quality properties that we can get in at a reasonable land basis and tear it down and build a new Class A building is, I see that as our best opportunities for the next several years. And that's to make outsized returns compared to finding, you know, an existing 100,000 square foot, 32 foot clear ESFR building that's got a tenant in tow. That's just a yield play, you know, and maybe we're going to get a little bit of arbitrage over that on that. Maybe it's a little bit of negative arbitrage. But if we're trying to get, you know, an over a 10-year average unlevered return on our equity, 10, 11, 12%, you can't do that buying an existing Class A building.
That's for sure. Sometimes the most money can be found in what people would normally see as waste or wasted opportunity. I'm curious, one of the things that I noticed the most when I was looking out and kind of understanding more about your firm was generally you guys have always been known for the waste management business originally. Can you speak a little bit more about that and kind of your philosophy of finding wasted opportunity and then waste management in general?
I love the comparison between wasted opportunities and waste management. So our company started in the early 80s. Our founder, Bernie Huberman, started out of high school driving a trash truck. And he built a collection business with his partner, Dan Rosenthal, and then moved into the infrastructure side in the mid to late 80s. So we got out of the collection business and moved into building and operating transfer stations, mainly because most of the in-region landfills in Southern California at the time were closing, and there was a need to have a halfway point between where trash was collected and then trash taken to a landfill. And that's what a transfer station is. You want your collection trucks collecting trash, not driving 70 miles to a landfill. They can get more trash picked up in a day per truck if they're depositing it off at a transfer station, where we then consolidate 5 trash trucks full of trash and take that to a landfill. So that was the wasted opportunity that we saw back in the 80s.
And I'm curious in terms of that and wasted opportunities. One of the things that we've increasingly seen and in the market and that I know you've discussed is there's huge waste in terms of particularly small class, you know, C and D industrial stuff that's antiquated or even retail that's kind of not functionally useful in today's e-commerce world. Have you seen a big push in terms of last mile delivery within your own portfolio? And how are you kind of using creative destruction and renewal in your portfolio to maybe drive opportunity?
Sure. I mean, we've seen a huge push in our market and our portfolio to last mile delivery. And we just got lucky because our transfer stations were generally built in downtown urban cores next to transportation nodes, including freeways and ports, which are, and especially freeways, it's great to have a last mile distribution facility. And so, you know, if you put a facility in, let's just say downtown LA, you can drive 1 mile radius from downtown LA and reach 10 million customers. You do it, excuse me, a 1 hour radius drive, you can reach 10 million customers. 2 hours, you can reach 20 million customers. And we just happen to have facilities, waste facilities in areas like that where we started buying industrial real estate. So yeah, the last mile distribution market has dramatically changed just over the last 10 years. And we've tried to stay in front of that wave.
What do you think is the biggest change that you're seeing in last mile delivery?
Well, start with the concept of last mile delivery. I don't think we had that term 10 years ago. So that is a dramatic change just to the overall industry. And it's changing so rapidly. So I would say 10, 15 years ago, we were talking about, you know, large facilities to take everything off the port that would then go to a distribution facility and you distribute from there. And now it's going from a manufacturing facility or port of entry facility to a distribution facility, then picked and packed and then sent to the last mile facility where it's then distributed from there. So I just think the incursion of last mile facilities closer and closer and embedded in communities is one of the biggest changes.
Last mile is certainly something that's we're going to see, I think, increasingly in real estate as well as just the world in general. One of the things that we like to do is we like to do on our final four, and I think we're going to get into that. We like to talk about the future. So where do you see real estate going over the next 10 years?
So I'm going to start again. My crystal ball is cracked, and I'm not great at making forecasts, but I think we've all heard that there's a French philosopher, the more things change, the more they stay the same. So I think on commercial real estate over the next 10 years, you're going to see technology trends that's going to make some changes. You're going to continue to see the consolidation of capital and assets in institutional owners. So there's going to be more and more consolidation, less owners in the business. I think from the more they change, the more they stay the same, nothing's going to change. There's still going to be, it's still the real estate business. It's still, we're all capital allocators. There's cycles. I still believe in cycles. Right now we're at the low point of a cycle. It's going to get, you know, let's see, cycles are usually 7 years and memories are 5 years. So things will, they're terrible right now. It'll get better. And then we'll have a bunch of irrational exuberance and capital will start flowing in back into the real estate business and we'll get to another bubble and then it'll pop again. And so I don't think over the next 10 years that is going to change.
We always like to go and look at the future, but one of the things that's interesting is sometimes taking a step back into the past. We have a lot of younger listeners on the podcast, and by younger, I'd say anybody under 35. And many of them are starting their real estate careers off either very young or maybe making a transition out of another sector of real estate, adjacent industries like finance or law. And if you could give one little bit of advice to yourself when you're starting out in the real estate industry, what would it be?
Take more risk. Don't be so serious and take more risk.
It's always great to lever up, particularly if you're picking right. One of the things we like to pick in every a podcast is a great book to read next. And I'm curious, is there a book that one of our listeners should be picking off the shelf?
Is it okay if I give you three books?
That's totally fine.
So I'm going to start with Danny Kahneman's book, Thinking Fast and Slow. Danny Kahneman and his partner Amos Tversky were kind of the fathers of behavioral economics. And I think that book just is, it's a long book, it's fantastic, but it really explains decision making and how we make decisions with, you know, the human brain. I think he says we have two different ways that our brain works, the fast thinking brain and the slow thinking brain. And shows through statistical and data analysis that while the fast thinking brain is really good for intuitive decisions, we make bad probabilistic decisions because of a number of biases that go along with that. And it's when we think slowly that we can think through those biases and make better probabilistic decisions. The second book is Peter Bernstein's Against the Gods, which is, another fantastic read and discusses again decision making. There's going to be a common theme here. Before the great mathematicians, there was no concept of risk. Everything was based on luck and what the gods said, and the mathematicians were able to show through math great probabilistic thinking, and that's how we went from probably pricing risk in a much better way because we could use probabilities to do that. Then the third book is Annie Duke's book, Thinking with Bets. Annie Duke was a professional poker player. She got her PhD in behavioral psychology, and she uses poker as a way to show how making decisions in an uncertain, with uncertainty. And her big theme is don't look at results to determine whether the basis of a good decision or not. And she uses poker because poker has both known information, unknown information, risk, and luck, and how you use all those things in decision.
Look, three phenomenal books. I know we've discussed behavioral economics at length on the podcast, and it's always great to have a behavioral economics book. But there's one last thing that we have to ask before we get to the end of the podcast, and it's the whole reason for the podcast. It's we firmly believe that the men and women in the arena know who to reach out to because they know who are the voices and who are the individuals that are doing great deals. And so I'm curious, who should be the next person on the podcast?
Should have never been me because I don't know that I'm a great voice. But if you could get Howard Schwimmer and Michael Frankel, the co-founders of Rexford Industrial, if you've got a large industrial audience, they've done a phenomenal job in the last 20 plus years of growing their portfolio from zero buildings to 48 million square feet, all in Southern California. The other person maybe you could speak to, since we're going for a moonshot, is I try to get a hold of John Gray from Blackstone, president of Blackstone. He has a very good insight in global real estate issues and capital flows.
Look, I'm in real estate, so I make a lot of cold calls. I've made more than one moonshot already today. I can't say if it landed or not, but we have to land one last question with you before we go. And that's simply, if somebody wants to reach out, what's the best way to get in touch?
My email, rsolomon@blt-enterprises.com, or you can go on our website, www.blt-enterprises.com.
Robert, thank you so much for hopping on the podcast today. I truly appreciate it, and we have to have you on in the future.
Love to. My pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks again to Robert. We appreciate his insights, and if you enjoyed the podcast, please give us a like, a 5-star rating, and a review. Your comments, interactions, and subscriptions truly matter and help us continue to provide quality guests. You can find us on YouTube, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Gordon Lanphier with the Real Finds Podcast. Thank you for listening.